10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so happy to be welcoming back into our studios, first of all, Professor Jeffrey Roberg, Professor of Political Science, Chair of the Department. He was just here last Wednesday, and we just didn't have quite enough of him. He was here with his colleague, Jerry Mast, to talk about the results of the Iowa caucus and to offer some thoughts on what might stretch ahead in this hotly contested presidential race. And But we knew all along that Professor Roberg was going to be visiting us soon thereafter, because he and his life partner and frequent collaborator, Penny Seymour, Professor Emerita of Psychological Studies, have just returned from a fascinating trip to Cuba, or Cuba, as we're supposed to more properly call it, but our neighbor just off the coast of Florida, which we've heard so much about over the last couple of years as the relationship between the United States and Cuba begins to change. So it's particularly interesting that the two of them were able to once again bring a group of Carthage students to Cuba to see what life is like there and the way in which life perhaps is beginning to change. And so we're really happy to not only have Professor Roberg and Professor Seymour, but also three Carthage students who were along on this trip. All three are sophomores. Let's see, who's who? Abby Roberts is a sophomore political science and Spanish major. Logan Bartz is a psychology and what does CJ stand
criminal
for?
Justice.
Criminal justice. Criminal justice major. And finally, Sam Johnson, who is an environmental science and Spanish major. We welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
And good to have both of you here as well. Jeff, sketch the history of the trips which you and Professor Seymour have taken over the years.
So for Carthage, our first trip to Cuba was in 2002. I did that one with another professor, another guest of yours often, Professor Yuri Maltsev. And then 2004, Penny collaborated with Professor Maltsev to start the new train of thought here in terms of the course that we offer these days. And I was a third professor on that one. And then we went from there to 2004. We had a period of time where we were not able to offer the course due to U.S. governmental changes in terms of who was allowed to travel to Cuba. And then we were able to reinstitute the course in 2014 and again traveled there in 2016, just recently, with this group of students.
I saw that essentially 10-year gap, and I was thinking it was probably not for lack of interest that you hadn't gone during that period. And you've probably even mentioned that change in policy. Just explain what ended up happening that made it possible again to go.
Sure. So during the Bush administration, the rules were changed in terms of the Department of Treasury has an office called OFAC, Office of Foreign Assets Control. And the Bush administration changed who was allowed to go and who wasn't. There have always been these categories of folks that could travel to Cuba legally, and those were tightened up so that educational exchanges were no longer possible of the type that Carthage does. And so we had to wait on that. Even before that, the paperwork had been quite onerous in 2002 and 2004. And then when President Obama came into office, he started loosening up some of those restrictions in 2009, 2010, and that then allowed us to think about going back.
And I'm sure, and I know from our conversation, it was an amazing experience to go back and see Cuba after all those years had elapsed. Professor Seymour, I wonder if you could say a word about what on the surface seems like a slightly odd partnership. I don't mean the two of you, two people. I mean the two disciplines, political science and psychological studies. The blending of those two into one experience, into one trip. Can you just talk a moment about that particular combination?
Well, when we're talking about the politics and the economics of a country, which is what Jeff talks about a lot, is that we can't forget the effect on the individual, and that's when we start looking at the psychology and the sociology of the culture and how it affects the individual and how the individual feels about the politics and the economy. And so you can't isolate the disciplines when you're looking at the effects of something like the embargo, because it's going to have both, a widespread effect on economics, politics, and the individual per se. And on the individual, you have to look at the idea of how much stress the individual has living under a system like this, where as we now talk about Cuba, as there are now the emergence of haves and have-nots in the country. And so that's been a really big focus of our studies for about the last couple of years. And then last year, you may not know that Jeff and I went to Cuba on our own to do some research there. And then we checked out some areas in the west of Cuba where we'd never been before. And we checked them out specifically for the environmental areas because there are two large UNESCO biodiversity sites in the west of Cuba. And so that was added into the trip this year.
So it gets just more and more interesting as you see more and more of this fascinating country. Remind us, Jeff, why Cuba? I mean, the world is full of interesting places to go. Did anything in particular draw you there in the first place for that initial trip with Professor Maltsev?
I wish I could say yes, other than the cool factor. But no, I mean, to be blunt about it, Professor Maltsev and I worked out a trade in 2002, and that is he was going to Cuba and I was taking students to Russia and the Baltics. Which I went on his and he went on mine. More seriously, so as you may recall, I'm an old Sovietologist. I was trained back in the days when the Soviet Union existed. My country went away, but nonetheless, the system largely remains, and a lot of that system still exists in Cuba today. So it was relatively easy to take some of my skills over to Cuba for investigations then, because the Soviet system, there's a large aspect of that is still the same. And so in terms of this course, the title of our course is Life and Politics, Surviving Socialism and the U.S. Embargo in Cuba. And so it really covers a broad swath of items that I've been looking at for a number of years.
Right. And then whose idea was it for the two of you to then collaborate? I mean, were you just hearing so much about this over the dinner table and realizing, oh, my gosh, this would be fascinating for me to study from my own academic perspective as well? Or kind of together did you come to realize that?
Well, Jeff and I have been collaborating since 2003. We started a collaboration in South America, in the northeast of Argentina.
Right.
And we were looking at, we decided that we could collaborate by taking our disciplines and meeting at the effects of tourism, because that has the ramifications of politics, economics, and psychology on individuals. And so we took the paradigm from South America that we've been using, and we decided that would work really well in Cuba, too, especially when we went back in 2014, because that's part of the reason that we now are seeing the emergence of haves and have-nots in a socialist country, because Cuba is relying on tourism to bring outside money into the country. And so we said, okay, this area is really ripe for us to go back and put this paradigm in place in Cuba also.
Excellent. For those of you just joining us, we have two Carthage professors with us, Professor Jeff Roberg from the Political Science Department and Professor Penny Seymour from Psychological Studies. Psychological Sciences?
Sciences. Yeah.
We have three students with us. We need to hear from them right now. Abby Roberts, Logan Bartz, and Sam Johnson. I'm very specifically interested in knowing what it was about this trip that inspired you to want to be part of it. I mean, were you interested in going to Cuba and studying it for any particular reason?
Well, I've studied Spanish for a number of years, and I've always heard about Cuba, but I never thought within my lifetime I'd be able to travel there. And when I heard about this trip, I had to be there because it had been a lifelong dream for me.
Mm. Did anything in particular entice you about the nation of Cuba?
Well, obviously the political aspects, because that is, again, my major.
Mm-hmm.
And just being able to see it at such an integral, pivotal point in time in the relations between the United States and Cuba. This is the time to go out of any.
When things are changing. It's like
yes,
being
indeed.
In Berlin when the wall comes down, that kind of thing, I suppose. How about you, Logan?
It's a pretty similar thing for me. In all honesty, the pivotal moment in history where we're at right now with relations in Cuba was really fascinating to me. Also, most people our age haven't been to Cuba. There's something just pretty cool about seeing a country most people your age haven't seen.
Mm.
And so I guess that's a good reason to
Absolutely.
Study.
Terrific. How about you, Sam?
Going off of what Abby said as well, I had been to Guatemala, but I wanted to practice a different type of Spanish, as that is my major as well. And so I wanted to practice the Spanish there. But also I had heard that Jeff was adding in the environmental science aspect, and that is another interest of mine. So I wanted to see how a communist country handles environmental science and environmental science issues compared to our country.
That's a that's a very, very compelling reason to want to go. And you said it's a different kind of Spanish spoken there?
The accent's different. The different colloquial terms are different. So just like the way they speak, and then also just different words that they have.
Fascinating. So how big a class are we talking about? How many students all together, and how wide a swath did they represent academically?
Sure. We took 23 people on this trip. 17 of them were current Carthage students. 6 were community members. Penny and I, for all of our trips, have opened our trips to community members, and they always add wonderful value to the discussions and the way that the trips occur. So we had 6 community members this time. As far as majors of current students, well, you've got some of those represented here. Beyond that, we can add biology, mathematics, sociology.
Psychological science.
We've got quite a number, some art and others as well. So there wasn't any one requirement in terms of you did not have to be a political science major, you did not have to be a psychology or psychological science major. It was open to anyone.
Yeah, we had social work. We had a broad swath, and of the 6 community members, 3 of them are alums from Carthage.
Ah, very good. So how long were you actually in Cuba within its borders?
15 nights.
Wow. good lengthy trip. And compared to the last time you went, were there drastic differences in planning the trip, organizing the trip, opportunities that were possible now that weren't before? Or was it, in terms of the laying out of the trip and implementing it, was it a roughly the same kind of experience?
Well, Jeff and I have been to Cuba 3 times now in 3 years, and we've seen tremendous changes over that time. And so we used a different trip provider this time, too, which gave us an opportunity to do some other things rather than what we had done in 2014. So on the 2014 and the 2016 trip, we actually covered half of the island. We covered 8 provinces on the island. So it gave the students a really good impression of the country from both rural areas and from city areas such as Havana and Trinidad and Santa Clara. But one of the big differences this time from the 2014 trip is in 2014 we took students to the U.S. interest section in Havana, and this time we took them to the U.S. embassy in Havana. Same building, different name, different function.
Because now we have a different kind of relationship. Were there more, for instance, more flight options? I mean, are more people traveling to Cuba now than were before?
Cuba was pretty packed with tourists this time. This time we took an American Airlines charter. They fly 22 flights a day 22 flights a week to Cuba from either Miami or Tampa to 5 different locations in Cuba. The United States has another couple of charter companies that go over, and those charters are really booked at this point in time, along with flights coming in from Canada, from Latin America, and from Europe. So it was pretty packed in the airport. But at the embassy, we were told that probably in midsummer, the United States will start allowing non-charter U.S. companies to fly into Cuba. Mm. And I have no idea how they're going to handle that, because the airport itself, the scene in the airport, took us almost 2 hours to get processed through and get our luggage and get out of there. Because there's only 2 luggage carousels in the airport terminal, and how they're going to start processing more flights coming in on a daily basis is going to be quite interesting.
Interesting, to say the least. Wow. To our 3 students, did you undertake this trip with any sense of trepidation? I mean, did it make you at all nervous or uncomfortable that you were traveling to a place like Cuba versus traveling to a place, for instance, like Spain, or not? Did you feel completely confident, completely safe right from the start?
I think the differences between Cuba and Spain has added more of a level of excitement than trepidation for me, because it was so much different than traveling to most other Spanish-speaking countries. In all honesty, in the class prior to leaving, we had a couple days of class where we learned about the history and a number of other things about Cuba. We went over the whole safety issue and all sorts of things, so I didn't feel any nerves traveling there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had complete confidence in our professors that they would keep us safe the entire time. And since I had been to Latin America before, I guess I was less nervous because I guess I had seen it before, and I had been nervous the year before, so I kind of knew what I was doing, if I guess you could say.
Right. Well, and here you are, safe and sound back home, so we're glad it all worked out as well as it did. Jeff, you were sketching out at least some of what occurred. What you described sounded like kind of a breakneck trip, I mean, in terms of a whole lot of stuff happening and a lot of ground being covered. Just talk for a moment about the way the two of you sort of laid out the trip and what needed to happen and at what sort of pace. I mean, I should think that's a really tricky challenge.
Sure. Fortunately, this isn't our first time doing this one, so we had a lot of groundwork already done. As Penny already mentioned, we decided to change our provider this time. Cuba, despite some opening from the U.S. side, we still are required to go through a provider in order to do these kind of trips. So with the change, that gave us a number of avenues. What that meant is while we still came stuck with the same paradigm in terms of looking at the effects of tourism, looking at the effects of the embargo, and looking at the effects of socialism on local Cubans, it gave us options in terms of some new lectures and discussions that we could do. We had a broad swath of excellent Cuban lecturers. We had a former Cuban ambassador. We had a current Cuban economist who was trained by the economist who advises Raul Castro today. We were able to meet with an urban planner who discussed not only the history of say, Havana and Cuba in general, but also a number of the issues that have to do with Cuba. I think for me, from the urban planner, the big takeaway was that every day, roughly three houses or buildings collapse, at least in part. and that has to do with that the city, 80% of Havana was built between 1900 and 1958. And when you think of that in those terms, it suddenly makes a lot of sense and explains a lot. Beyond that, we were able to meet with up-and-coming folks. We had a communications computer specialist that met with us who had created his own computer program, which was frankly ingenious the way that it was set up. And architects and historians and such, and so we really had a broad swath of fine lectures to help add color and fill out our goals for the trip. In addition to then guides and meetings that we had having to do with the environmental side of things, such as we had set up a meeting with the National Park Rangers in the Guanacabibas Peninsula way out west.
Mm-hmm. How much of these interactions were in Spanish versus English? I mean, how much had to be translated, for instance, for the group?
Well, the lectures were all in English.
Okay.
So
English is commonly spoken in Cuba.
Well, English is commonly spoken among more educated folks. And then even, this gets us into a question of education in terms of Cuba, and this is a value that the system has. And so a lot of people are educated and learning English. They have figured out that because of the increase in tourism, English is a good commodity to have in terms of their skills and how to interact with tourists. There was no Spanish language requirement for joining this study tour.
Hmm. So tell us, I'll turn to the three students now. Tell us something about the way you got around. And were you always together? Were you ever sort of on your own to kind of do whatever you wanted? Were you wanting to do that? Were you allowed to do that? Describe that to us.
For the most part, we split off into groups because most of the eating places and social places we went to couldn't accommodate all 23 of us at once. So we had to kind of find our own way with a smaller group of people.
Right. So there was some splitting off there.
Yeah. There was a good portion of the trip was scheduled together as a group, but there were ample opportunities to go split off on your own. Actually, when we got into one place we were staying, Vinales, we sort of just got dumped off the bus to go head to our casas particulares, which are like sort of bed and breakfast setups. So we're all split into different houses, and just we were told where to meet at 9 o'clock the next morning. But other than that, we were just left to our own devices to find our way around the city and explore. And that actually led to really interesting experiences where you got to see what the city really looks like and wandering around, finding your own way.
Wow.
Definitely. Vinales was sort of our first opportunity to be on our own, but once we got to Havana, it was like on average 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock every day. We were just set free and to explore the capital.
Wow. Well, that's exciting. Is that typically what's happened?
Yes, it is, as much as we can. This is the first trip, though, to Cuba where we've had students stay in private homes in these Casa Particulares, and that wasn't an option that we really knew about a couple of years ago. And then when Jeff and I went to Cuba last year on our own, we insisted that we be accommodated in Casa Particulares instead of in the few hotels that Cuba actually has that are normally well out of town. And so in Vinales and in Trinidad and in Santa Clara, we were able to put students in private homes, and that gave them the opportunity to have conversations with the owners and the staff of the Casa Particulares.
So, and these pretty much are bed and breakfasts? That's the best way to think of them?
Yeah, that's the way to think about them. Breakfast is always included. And then they can negotiate if they want to have dinner in the casa, or they can also negotiate if they want to have laundry done or some other types of things. And some of the casa owners will actually even provide guide services and other than that.
Wow. Well, tell us more about the places where you stayed, the kind of experiences that you had in these, what are they, Casa Particulares, did you say? Let's hear more about that.
Well, it was interesting because it was very much like being in their own personal home. And it was great to be able to see that sort of aspect and interact with them. And the food was phenomenal.
It also depended on what city you were in to see, like, what kind of casas there were. So in Vinales, at least ours was one story, pretty small, just one bedroom. But then when we got to Trinidad, which is a lot more touristy of a place, it was three stories and it had five bedrooms. So depending where you were, it could change a lot. And then the food would change with each casa and... it was very different experiences. And then Santa Clara, as Seymour mentioned, that was more apartment style. So it was one bedroom, but in an apartment building instead.
How much interaction did you end up having with the owners or is that what we call it? They own these and run them. I mean, how much did it feel like you were staying in a small hotel versus staying in someone's home? I mean, what did the interaction feel like? Did that vary a lot place to place?
Again, like Sam was talking about, the CASA experience depended a lot on where you were. So the first place we stayed in Vinales was much smaller, and I know my roommate and I personally had a lot more interaction with the people running our CASA because it's a very small private home, and we're just right there next to their family. Whereas in Trinidad was much larger. There were a number of rooms within one CASA, and so that felt more like a small hotel.
And more of that kind of a transaction versus somebody inviting you into their own home. So what kind of conversations did you end up having, to whatever extent there were conversations?
I usually ask my CASA madres and padres about how long they had run the CASA, their thoughts on the tourism industry and how it had been affecting them, and things like that.
Yeah. I'm afraid my Spanish is terribly limited, so a lot of my interactions with my CASA madres and padres either occurred when Abby happened to be visiting us or were mostly just us desperately attempting to find food. But we did get at one point to talk about how long they'd been running it, what they felt like running the casa.
For ours, since the couple times we were staying like in the bedroom next to the owners, then I wanted to get to know them more because we were very close. So in Santa Clara and Vinales, we just get to know them, ask about their kids, talk to the kids, see if they like school, you know, normal things you'd do with kids. But then in Trinidad, since we had just gotten back from a talk about gender roles in society and machismo, I was still very interested in that. So I had talked to our CASA mom about how she felt. It's very prevalent to have catcalling in the streets in most of Latin America. And so I talked to my CASA mom about that to see if it was typical for all types of Cubans, just tourists. So we had about an hour-long conversation about gender roles and equality. So that was deep.
Yeah, no kidding. I'd like to hear more about that. First of all, who was sort of the official that you talked about, or who there was some kind of lecture or something about that specific topic?
We talked to, we had a talk from a woman artist in Trinidad about gender roles, and she talks about one of the problems in Cuba is so many women marry very young. They marry at 15 or 16, even though they may have some education, that the families are eager for them to marry and get on with their lives, and she's been trying to combat that. We also, before we left, I talked about gender and gender equality in Cuba, and I talked about an organization, a State Department called CENESEX, that is headed by Raul Castro's daughter, Mariela Castro, who's a member of the National Assembly. And CENESEX has been around since 1989. And it was actually one of the founding members of it was Vilma Espín, who was Raul Castro's wife, who died about 5 years ago. And so Senisex is based on the idea of equality in sexual relations, in gender relations. And so they have promoted a lot of laws and a lot of education in Cuba about sexual equality. And so that's helped to educate Cuba, but on the ground you actually still see a lot of machismo happening. Mm.
Did you experience much of that firsthand?
Oh, yes.
Whenever I went out to restaurants with people, I was usually the one translating and interacting with the waiters because of my Spanish experience. But whenever the bill would come, it would go to the male of the table, despite the fact that I was the one doing the order.
Ah, interesting. And that's probably a fairly modest example of, example of what we're talking about. Interesting. Tell us about what the country, generally speaking, looked like in terms of, opulence. Did it, as you were walking around, and I'm sure there's differences between the metropolitan areas where you were and places that were more rural and remote, but did it seem like a country that had money, or did it seem like a poor third world country, or sort of a cross between the two?
I very much noticed that it looked like a country that used to have money. You'd see these big buildings that were started but never finished. Built bridges that were, they had begun building the bridge, but there was no connection. The bridge wasn't actually finished. So
like you couldn't cross.
Right, exactly. Or you see train tracks, but you wouldn't see any new trains. So you'd see that a while ago they had money for infrastructure, but then funding stopped and you could tell everything was pretty much abandoned.
Wow.
Additionally, there was a really interesting, it's a country where there's a lot of certain people who have money, and then the vast majority does not. So you'd see a lot of large, opulent buildings that had not been well kept up, but if you looked at the National Hotel, that was absolutely beautiful, stunning, one of the most beautiful buildings I've ever seen. Or you'd see certain casas where they'd had the influx of tourist money and had the ability to keep up their house, and then it was beautiful and wealthy, but otherwise you'd see shacks crumbling into the street.
Wow. So it's a nation of vast disparity from the sounds of it. Can we talk about the matter of infrastructure and what that's about and what Sam is describing? To what do we attribute that? And is it literally as she described? I mean, the way it appears, is that in fact the case?
We can talk about it in several different aspects. So the first thing that you heard the students talking about is differences between different cities and areas that we were in. So even within the same city, you might have, relatively speaking, very wealthy versus not wealthy. The Casa Particulares have particularly put in quite a bit of income into local Cubans' hands. And that has certainly been life-transforming in many, many ways. We can also, though, talk about those. Not everyone has the ability to do a Casa Particular. The house that they might have does not have the extra space, or they haven't been able to acquire the cash to build an extra room, or even be able to give up a room based on having kids or whatnot. So that's first. Secondly, if we're talking about Havana is its own separate animal, if you will. And that is that there's what they call Habana Vieja, which is Old Havana, which is tourist central, if you will. And so due to policies for about 20 years now, the government has put quite a bit of money into Old Havana to try and build it up, to try and have tourists go there. However, that means that other parts of Havana have not been receiving the same kind of cash. In general, though, in terms of the infrastructure issues that Sam mentioned, those are very real. And the problem there has to do, well, there are many reasons, but the first and foremost, only 1.6% of the gross domestic product is attributed to or put towards infrastructure investment. And so infrastructure, of course, applies to a variety of things in terms of roads, in terms of bridges, certainly so, but also water, sanitation, you name it, right, electricity, the whole gamut. And so in terms of Havana, what you may have is you may have some nice places, or at least places that have a coat of paint on them, versus places that are right next door that may have a wall that's crumbling or such. And it's easy to understand when you think of the average income of Cuban citizens. So if you're a state employee, the average income is approximately $20 US a month.
Wow.
A can of paint is going to cost you just under $5 US a month.
Right.
So where are you going to put your priorities?
Right.
And so we designed this course really so that the students would see these contrasts in these different areas and between cities and within cities.
Yeah. I'm particularly curious about Sam describing, for instance, partially completed bridges, that kind of, where it looked like things began but were not finished. And is that also literally the case? And if so, why? I mean, why would you start to build a bridge and not finish it, for instance?
Well, mainly money right. would be the answer to that. Last year, Jeff and I actually in the West rented a small car about the size of a smart car. And we drove the west of Cuba on our own, so we got a really good look at infrastructure in the West. And we ran into a number of places off the beaten track where we had to either drive across a one-lane bridge on wooden planks, hoping that we wouldn't get the tires off of them, or actually we had to drive down through a gully and up the other side to get across the stream that we needed to cross, because the bridge either hadn't been finished or it had been finished a long time ago and was falling apart. And so if you think about this, this is something that the typical Cuban who lives, especially out in the country, sees on a daily basis.
Mm.
And the roads aren't kept up. And even the autopista, which is a four-lane divided highway, very much like a freeway, there are often big potholes in them, along with dogs and people walking and hitchhikers and ox carts bridges, overpasses that aren't finished. And then you see buildings. There's one in particular in Trinidad that we've been photographing for a number of years now that hasn't changed very much over the years other than the sign that says when it's going to be completed.
So they keep changing that.
That's right. And so we see these kinds of problems throughout the eight provinces that we visited in Cuba. And it's that money just is not going into infrastructure, even though you have lots and lots of tourists coming in and the tourist numbers are rising now. And how they're going to start housing as many tourists that are coming in is going to be a real issue.
And do you think it is it a matter that there is just not enough money, or is it that the money they have, they are making poor choices about where their money is being put?
Yes. So yes, there is not enough money at this point, and yes, there are poor choices happening. And related to what Penny was saying, transportation's a big part of that. So as the students got to see very quickly after we landed, the autopista is largely empty, where you could walk across the highway without any fear of getting hit for 5 minutes. There's not a lot of transportation going on there, and that means that products are not getting to where they need to go, and people are not necessarily getting to where they need to go. I think one of the places that made it hit home the best was a community we took the students to called Community Pellegrin, which the students will remember. There are about 7,000 people that live in this community. And do you remember how many cars?
Six.
Wow.
And those six are private cars, privately owned. So what do you do?
Well, I guess you do a lot of walking or ox cart riding or something.
Yes, you do.
You don't leave the town.
Yeah. So of the people you ended up really interacting with, for the most part, were you talking to haves or have-nots? Because we've been hearing a lot about how that disparity is one of the real hallmarks of Cuban society right now. By and large, who were you interacting with, and what kinds of things did you come away learning?
Well, by nature of us interacting mainly with the service industry, we are, for the most part, interacting with the haves because they're getting tourism money that's not completely taxed by the government. So we were mainly talking with people who were very well off in terms of the country.
Mm-hmm. Right. It kind of depended what you did with your free time. If you went to a restaurant or to a place to hang out, you were handling people in the service industry, the people that are haves. But if you, when we were in Havana, for example, my friend and I would just walk around the streets and we would just go into neighborhoods and talk to people on the streets. So we were having conversations with all sorts of people, even have-nots, because we were avoiding the service industry and just walking.
Right.
One of the really interesting phenomena we encountered was a lot of people who were in transition, so people who had been previously employed by the government or working. We talked to a couple of cab drivers who had just been farmers, so people who had switched into the tourism industry to start trying to earn that money and switch over, I guess, from the have-nots to the haves.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I suppose for a lot of them, even as individuals themselves, they're experiencing a lot of this turbulence and this split. I'm a little amazed, Sam, that you two did this also, but I mean, like, just going off into neighborhoods essentially completely on your own, that just seems like a, what is the word, audacious thing to do? or somewhat risky? You didn't feel like you were putting yourself in harm's way at all?
I guess I had asked our guide a couple times, like, is the neighborhood safe? I had asked Roberg, are the neighborhoods safe? And I'd always gotten yes. So, I mean, nothing bad ever happened. We would just talk to random people on the street, and it was fine. The people are very, very friendly. As much as there is that gender inequality and, like, gender roles, it was obvious to see, but not really experience, I guess. Like, no one would do anything. I always felt safe, no matter where we were.
Yeah.
And we were fairly obviously tourists, so we had that kind of safe bubble around us.
Oh, really? So that makes a difference, then.
There is a benefit to an authoritarian society in that regard, in terms of when it comes to security. But with the socialism aspect, you have a collective responsibility. And by virtue of us being there, we are now part of the collective. And so, the locals felt a responsibility to help when necessary. That doesn't mean that there aren't bad people occasionally, right? We have those all over the place.
Sure.
Here in the United States as well. But for the most part, this is Dr. Seymour and I never were concerned, shall we say, when students went off on their own. And frankly, we encouraged it. That was part of the study tour. That was also one of the assignments. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So your motto is talk to strangers rather than never talk to strangers.
Yes.
And I also feel like since the economy is so based on tourism, as Abby said, we were clearly tourists. So there was, again, that collective interest to make sure nothing happened.
Right. And a sense of deference and also protectiveness, I suppose, because it's certainly in their best interests for tourists to leave the country safe and intact and happy. What about the attitude that Cubans, generally speaking, had towards you in terms of being Americans? I mean, did you pick up much sense of antagonistic feelings towards the United States or our policies? Of course, you were coming at a point when much of that is changing.
Aside from a few exceptions, it was mainly joy that we were there that I experienced, which I was very happy about. That was one of my main worries going into the trip, that we would be greeted with some sort of antagonism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't recall any real noticeable instances of anti-American sentiment or anything like that. A lot of what we got, actually, when we were talking to the real people, like the cab drivers, the servers, were a lot of, we're not so different. We actually heard that a couple times.
Yeah.
We're just really not that different as people. Different countries, different governments, but not different people.
Mm. And also to talking to people, there was a common theme that just because our governments may do things that the other people don't like doesn't mean the people do things that we don't like. So it's more so your government made those decisions, not you. We can't hold it against you personally.
Oh.
I think that's an important theme.
Right. It's great that they had the sense of making that distinction. It's not something people always do. It's something, a distinction we don't always make, certainly as Americans.
You may also be interested, and your listeners might like this, that as far as popularity level, President Obama is at the 80% rank in popularity in Cuba, which is almost twice as high as Raul or Fidel at this point in time.
Interesting. So, Professor Seymour, this matter of Cuban society being so drastically reshaped, in a sense, or certainly daily life, by this huge influx of tourism and now this real split between haves and have-nots. What means have you sort of employed to approach that matter from your own academic discipline in terms of kind of understanding psychologically what people are going through? How have you studied that seriously?
Well, one of my biggest concerns is that there are people being left out of this economic disparity. And this is a country that was built on the socialist paradigm that everybody was equal. And so one of the things that I taught in this class before we even left was ideas of racism, sexual equality, of haves and have-nots, of some generational differences. I'm concerned especially about the divisions in society. And I'm seeing a lot of people who are educated, well-educated in Cuba, and it is a well-educated country, who are leaving their professions and going into tourism because they could make more money in tourism as a doctor or more money in tourism than they could as a doctor or a lawyer or an architect.
Wow.
Or a teacher. And so one of the things that we're seeing is that a lot of the guides were teachers. And so this is causing a problem in Cuba. There's a growing shortage of doctors because they're leaving the profession because they're underpaid, and there's a growing shortage of teachers. And so the Cuban government really needs to do something about lessening the inequality in paying its working professionals a lot more money than it is now, because going into tourism is a lot more attractive for people, but not everybody has that opportunity. Hmm. Plus, there's a disparity between those who have relatives who've left the country and now send remittances back from the United States or from Europe, and they're living their lives a lot better than people who are not receiving remittances. And we know some elderly Cubans who don't have families out of the country who are struggling to get by on their version of Social Security. Mm. And their lives are not going to get better unless the government does something to reduce the inequality.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Some really vexing issues there, very, very serious, that affect so many people's lives in so many ways. And it's 8:57. I can't believe how fast the time has gone. Ladies, 30 seconds each. What was your favorite thing to eat in Cuba? Or unless the thing that was your least favorite is more interesting to talk about.
I guess, actually, a good transition from what Dr. Seymour just said. We met a man who was selling churros on the street, who was a hotel manager but could get more money selling churros, and he had the best churros in Cuba.
All right. There you go.
We actually had dinner at one of our Casas Particulares one time, and it was a vast array of food, more food than I could ever possibly consume, but that was perhaps the best meal I have ever had, much less just in Cuba.
Wow.
Yeah, approximately every meal at our Casa Particulares was phenomenal. And I had one over at their Casa, so I could talk to their Casa family and see them as well. Oh, wow. And they had this squash soup, and it was phenomenal. And I don't like squash, so it was very impressive that I liked it.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you all came away with a rich array of very, very interesting experiences here in this trip that you were able to make to Cuba. And again, what an exciting time to go with the country in such dramatic transition, and we hope transitioning to a new life that will be better for most of its citizens. But there's certainly no solid answers about that, so you have to go back. When was the next time you'll be back to Cuba?
Don't know at this point.
Oh, okay. Well, when you get back, you're coming back here. So these conversations are always so interesting. Professor Penny Seymour, Professor Jeff Roberg, and our three students with us as well, Sam Johnson, Logan Bartz, and Abby Roberts. Great to have all of you today here on The Morning Show. This was fascinating.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find it archived at WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Cloudy and seasonal today with some snow showers. Very little accumulation, a high of 33 degrees. Cloudy and cold overnight, possibly an inch of snow tonight with a low of 19 degrees. Tomorrow, Tuesday, cloudy and windy, a 90% chance of snow showers, possibly another inch of accumulation with a high of just 23 degrees. Wednesday's high just 14. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.